I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Judge Robert Simpson of Commonwealth Court is expected to rule this week on a challenge to Pennsylvania's new voter identification law. The law requires residents who vote to present a state-approved photo ID at the polls. It was supported, passed, and then signed by Governor Corbett, ostensibly to prevent voter impersonation fraud. Critics have argued, though, that this kind of voter fraud rarely occurs and the law will end up disenfranchising voters. Polls have generally found that the public supports these laws, but those results can depend on a number of factors, including how questions are phrased. This is all our topic for today's Radio Times, and we begin with David Wilson. He's a professor of political science and international relations and psychology at the University of Delaware, where he also serves as coordinator of public opinion initiatives at the University Center for Political Communications. He's one of the authors of a new study on public support for voter identification laws. And David Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you today.
How much does the public know about these laws and even the controversy about them?
Well, they're getting more information now that the laws are becoming more kind of contested in different courts in different areas. But in our poll, we actually found that the public was pretty much unfamiliar with these laws. We found that about 75% to 77% were somewhat or not at all familiar with the laws. And that tells us, you know, when you have 3 out of 4 people who are not really familiar with them, then that means that they can be framed in ways that make people support them or oppose them, depending upon the rhetoric and where the laws are being presented.
And I do want to get in more detail in some of the polling that you have done. But broadly speaking, even looking at a number of polls besides what you have done, it looks like the public generally supports these voter ID laws. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, that'd be a fair assessment. I mean, the real question is most in the public don't see a big issue with getting getting the identification required to vote. Things like driver's license, a passport, birth certificate. Most people will make the argument that, you know, hey, when I want to go, you know, do something, I need to show ID. So everybody should have ID. And if you don't, then something may be wrong. You may have there may be a reason why you don't that signals that you shouldn't be voting anyway. So,
well, it's interesting you say that because we've done several shows on this and we've certainly gotten callers that have said that very thing.
Right. Well, just so we're clear, I mean, the issue is not about 50 to 60% of the electorate. It's about 5 to 7%.
Right.
And so, if you can make that difference in an election contest with 5 to 7% of the vote, then that's pretty much guaranteeing a win.
What are the questions? How have you framed your questions when you're doing polling on this?
Well, what's interesting is that there hasn't been very much public opinion polling done on the issue of voter ID laws. Most of what's been done has looked at how states that have certain laws, how that law affects turnout in the state. And you can look at the turnout over midterm elections and presidential election years. And most of the research shows that there was pretty much no effect. So what we wanted to see was whether or not presenting, you know, information about the laws actually will influence how people think about them and whether or not they favor or oppose them.
Go ahead.
And I was going to say, what we found is that when you have arguments about things like fraud or that they keep ineligible people from voting or they prevent people from voting multiple times, that makes no difference in people's levels of support when you compare that versus having no information with the question. But when you frame the question as taking away the right to vote for people who are eligible to vote, then you see support go down.
You also have tapped into what you describe as racial resentment, and I'm looking at a couple of questions that you have asked on this particular issue. One is, I resent any special considerations that African Americans receive because it's unfair to other Americans. What's the importance of how you frame that question?
Well, the key is that, number one, special considerations is that African Americans are somehow receiving some benefit that everybody else is not getting, which is immoral and which is considered unfair. And the added part to the question is that because it has an effect on me. So that's one of the three questions in our measure of racial resentment.
Right.
You know, you have to basically have a resentful response to all three of those questions in order to have higher levels of racial resentment. So the key to that question is, what is the source of people's angst towards African Americans? And in our research and many other studies in political science and political psychology, we found is that the public perceives African Americans as not doing their part, as getting benefits that they don't deserve. And you see a lot of rhetoric that kind of taps into this idea.
Well, in fact, and looking at some of your findings here, 15% strongly agreed with that statement and 23% somewhat agreed with that statement.
Yeah, we tend to find a lot of higher levels of racial resentment in the public. I mean, the key thing to remember, though, is that racial resentment ranges on a continuum of low to high. Yes. So you do find people who agree more with it or agree less and disagree more and disagree less.
Here are the two other questions. Special considerations for African Americans place me at an unfair disadvantage because I have done nothing to harm them.
That's correct, right. So in other words, the idea is that, hey, this is not my problem. I didn't do anything to put them in this position. They should be fine. Why am I getting blamed or why am I being targeted for their problems that they have? Again, it taps into this kind of ethnocentric idea that we're two different groups. They're somehow receiving some benefit. I'm somehow being penalized. Any laws such as affirmative action or things of that nature that give out special treatment, even the acknowledgement of something like Black History Month, taps in angst towards that, taps into the idea of racial resentment.
Let me read the final sentence. African Americans bring up race only when they need to make an excuse for their failure.
Right. One of the key components of racial resentment is the discounting that of race, that it doesn't matter now. It's a thing of the past. And when people do use it, they are somehow making an excuse for their own position. They're not tapping into a legitimate concern.
So how does this racial resentment that you investigated here, how does that show up then in these voter ID polling?
Well, we actually found that people who have higher levels of racial resentment, of course, are more likely to support these laws. Now, some would argue that maybe that racial attitudes are tied into conservatism and being a Republican. And we actually do find that Republicans and conservatives have higher levels of racial resentment. But the interesting part about our poll is that we found that the biggest effect of racial resentment on support for voter ID laws occurs among Democrats and liberals.
Interesting.
And primarily our belief is that, of course, if you're a Democrat or a liberal, you tend to be against voter ID laws, but if you're for them, what is the basis of that support? And if they don't, if they don't think it's, if there's a problem with it legally, then it must be that, okay, well, maybe it's tapping into some idea that people are voting who shouldn't be voting.
Which is, and this is not, it seems like voting has been so fraught in this country. I mean, not only do you look back at civil rights and giving women the vote, giving African Americans the vote, this seems like it's been such a contentious issue through our history.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of us in political science who've studied the issue know about how the parties realigned around the issue of race. Mm-hmm. We're also very familiar with the Civil War and the issues that happened in America's history. But there is a concern that when you add in voter ID laws with other things like purging voter lists and using felon lists and crime lists to kind of take people off the voting rolls, that there's something nefarious behind there, that there's something going on that's trying to keep people from voting. And so then you look at, okay, well, what would motivate or what would be the rationale for the laws then? And if the argument is fraud, the evidence shows that there's not much fraud. So our goal has been to find out not only what's the motivation behind the laws, but what's the motivation behind the public supporting these laws at such a high level.
But are you also saying that this racial resentment that you found in some of your polling, that it's different for liberals than it is for conservatives, for instance?
What we think is that there's so much agreement among Republicans and conservatives around the issue of race, and there's much more disagreement or variance among liberals and Democrats. And so you tend to have more homogeneity among conservatives and Republicans, and so you don't see an effect there. But you do see an effect because Democrats are more varied. You have more conservative Democrats and you have more liberal Democrats. Among Republicans, primarily you have somewhat moderate and very conservative. So there's much more diversity within the Democratic Party, and therefore you have much more diversity of ideas. If everybody thinks the same way about race among Republicans and conservatives, you won't see an effect there.
And is this have you done other polling on the voter ID and this notion of racial resentment?
We haven't done it specifically on racial resentment and voter ID laws. Again, there's very limited polling on public opinion towards voter ID laws. So we have looked at attitudes towards candidates, attitudes towards policy issues, attitudes towards events. And in most cases, we find a very consistent pattern that racial resentment predicts attitudes towards the president, Barack Obama. It predicts attitudes towards the Democratic Party. It even predicts attitudes towards some things that are ostensibly non-racial, such as disenfranchisement laws, immigration, those kinds of things.
And will you continue to do more polling on this issue? It's intriguing, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have regularly measured racial resentment in the American electorate since around the late 1980s. So we continue to find the effects of racial resentment. And the key is, when are racial attitudes primed versus when are they not primed? In other words, we don't believe that Americans are walking around just waiting to be racist. We believe that certain words, certain ideas, certain symbols prime racial attitudes and are therefore more accessible to Americans when they have to make a decision or a judgment about politics.
What I found so interesting about those three questions we've been talking about is they are very direct questions. There's nothing subtle about those questions.
Right.
And I'm assuming by design.
That's right. I mean, you actually could make an argument that people don't mind answering those questions because they can justify them on kind of non-racial grounds. So they are explicit in that they mention race and that they are making a statement about African Americans. But in most cases, those questions, you can say, oh, there is some truth to that, and I can justify it without actually seeming that I'm explicitly racist. And again, we don't make the argument that racism and racial resentment are the same. Most people do characterize them because they have no other way to think about racial attitudes. But in general, there's a quite legitimate concern that people could have about African Americans, but they're not trying to keep them down as a group. They're not making a biological justification for their position. They're just saying that, look, I believe in this stereotype, and I think it tends to be true.
I'm about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but even going back to what you were saying earlier in terms of the way these questions are framed, questions about voter ID, the use of the word fraud or other words that might get people to think that perhaps my vote doesn't count. How significant is that?
I'm sorry, I didn't get how significant is the use of the word fraud?
Things like fraud. Yeah.
Yeah, I think fraud is used as kind of a rhetorical device to kind of get people riled up and to think about why we need to protect the sanctity of the ballot box. But again, the evidence pretty much shows that there's very, very little fraud. In fact, there was a new study that was just put out by a news channel that showed that of the 60 million or so votes that have been cast, there were maybe about 2,000 instances of fraud, and a very few of those were about impersonation fraud, which is what your voter ID laws are about.
In fact, it's what our show is about as well. Right. David Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Professor of Political Science and International Relations and Psychology at the University of Delaware. He also serves as the coordinator of public opinion initiatives at the University Center for Political Communications. We will continue our conversation, talk more about voter ID laws and voter fraud. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington supports WHYY. When someone is injured or ill, a long wait in the ER can be damaging. According to the Centers for Disease Control, average ER wait times are nearly 1 hour. St. Francis's Emergency Services team has worked to reduce the time to get patients into treatment rooms or to give them direct care to 30 minutes or less. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
Next time in Studio 360, this respectable, straight-laced, middle-aged couple becomes obsessed with the dance of passion.
They say, but you don't look like somebody who's danced tango. I probably look very nerdy.
Blame it on the tango. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Linnea Johnson was the kind of bright, sensitive teen mothers worry about. A job made infinitely harder when sensitive became suicidal.
The darkest spot was when she said, "Just let me go."
Perfect Chaos, a new memoir that tells a mother-daughter fight for mental health. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A Pennsylvania judge is expected to rule on the Commonwealth's new voter ID law sometime this week. It will be a very closely watched decision. We just said goodbye to David Wilson from the University of Delaware, who has done some polling on voter ID laws. And joining us now is Lorraine Maniti, and she's Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration, Director of Undergraduate Urban Studies, the Undergraduate Urban Studies Program at Rutgers University at their Camden campus, author of a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud and Keeping Down the Black Vote. And Lori Maniti, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I hate to begin with a definition, but we hear this phrase voter fraud used so much, and I think sometimes used incorrectly. When we talk about voter fraud with you, how do you define it?
I try to define it in a pretty simple, straightforward way, and that is that it's the intentional corruption of the electoral process by voters. So I kind of distinguish between who's doing it, and also I think it's important to the definition to point out that it is intentional behavior. It's criminal behavior, and it's therefore intentional.
You have been writing about this issue for a number of years now. I know that I was reading some things that you wrote back in 2007. Of course, that's 5 years ago. There seems to be a strong belief that there is a problem of voter fraud in the United States, and yet your research from others, has found that it's very rare. Why this disconnect?
Well, I think it probably has a lot to do with what your previous guest was talking about a little bit, which is the generalized notion that politics are corrupt. You hear the word fraud all the time, and the idea has both been planted and sort of exaggerated and used for political purposes, but it is tapping into something deeper that people probably feel about politics, and they not everybody like me who stays glued to the computer or the news or whatever, following political news all the time. Most people probably aren't doing that, so they're not making these kinds of academic distinctions and really being able to look into the allegations. I would also say that I think the media is doing a much better job these days of sort of asking better questions when these allegations are made, usually by people who have a political interest in keeping the myth alive that there's a lot of fraud. And, people probably also are somewhat familiar with some of the most colorful events of our political history in the United States. And even Boss Tweed, the famous 19th century political boss in New York, makes an appearance in the most important Supreme Court decision on the question of voter ID. Justice Stevens, who wrote the decision in the Crawford case, which upheld Indiana's voter ID law, sort of made a reference to Boss Tweed lurking in the background. And so it's tapping into the mythology and to the political history that we do have. So it's not really surprising that people might think that there is a lot of fraud in elections.
Well, looking at your research, and you've looked at this issue of voter impersonation, and that would be that I would go to the polls pretending that I'm you, using some kind of fraudulent ID card. How often has that happened?
Marty, that almost never happens in contemporary elections. And my research focused intensively on really the decade of 2000 and after the 2000 election. And as your previous guest did mention, students at the University of Arizona in their journalism school there just this weekend presented the results of their research into this and concluded and confirmed essentially what I had argued and found in my book published a couple of years ago, that it almost never happens. There's simply no evidence of it. And why is there no evidence? You have to think about what's the rationale for doing it. There really is none to the average voter. Political scientists tend to scratch their heads a little bit about this because they work from a model that voting is, like a lot of things we do, is a sort of rational choice.
Right.
You know, what's the cost to me? How much time is it going to take? To the benefit, how important is it to me that I participate, that I, you know, give my vote to my preferred candidate? That somebody would want to do it more than once is a little strange to comprehend at an individual level, you know, at the level of the individual person. And do individual voters have the means to do it? You know, we have laws against it. We have procedures in place to prevent it. So when you break it down that way, I think it's a little easier to understand why it probably isn't happening. And again, no state that has been sued over their voter ID law has been required to show in court that they have a problem with that kind of fraud. You mentioned the Pennsylvania case. I know your listeners are probably pretty aware of what's going on with that. And in that case, the state actually stipulated in a document in court that they had no fraud of this kind. They had no investigations. They had no convictions. They had no knowledge of it. So I think really the burden should be on those who want to argue that it's an endemic problem to be able to document it.
Well, let me quote from that study that you just quoted from that came out over the weekend, News 21. It's a Carnegie Knight investigative reporting project, and they found, and I'm quoting here, the analysis of 2,068 reported fraud cases by News 21 found that 10 cases of alleged in-person voter impersonation since 2000. So out of and I'm totally stumbling over my words here. With 146 million registered voters in the United States, the numbers of cases of alleged in-person voter impersonation since 2000 represents one for every 15 million prospective voters. And again, I kind of mangled all that, but it's very rare.
Yes. Yes. It's very rare, and it's hard to understand why it wouldn't be rare, I think.
Well, I had interviewed Pennsylvania Secretary of State Carol Achel on this, and one of the things that she said when I frankly challenged her on her position and what the state was doing is that she said, you know, it's very difficult to root out fraud. Fraud exists because it's by its very nature, it is fraudulent and under the radar. As an example or an explanation about why there were not more actual cases. Does that argument hold water with you?
No, it really doesn't hold water with me. And, as you mentioned, I have been studying this actually for 10 years. I've been studying deep into this issue. And what I've come to see is that, you know, the arguments for the voter ID laws tend to shift when the lack of an evidentiary basis for them is kind of convincing. And this is this kind of an argument that fraud is hard to detect. But that also doesn't really make sense. All crime is meant to be concealed. All crime. Most criminals don't want to get caught. So the fact that voter fraud, if it's happening, that there's something special about it that is meant to be concealed, really doesn't distinguish it in any way. And if you also think about it this way, the federal government has a manual that they use in trying to train their U.S. attorneys in how to identify, prosecute, investigate voter fraud. And that manual points out that if voter impersonation is probably more likely to be caught than other forms of fraud because the person committing the crime has to actually commit it in front of the official who has the authority to catch them in doing it. So it's not like sneaking into somebody's house and stealing something and when nobody is there. You have to commit the crime right there in front of the officials. So, you know, the argument that it's somehow a special, secret, hard-to-catch crime just doesn't make much sense to me. And where I've, again, where I've looked for that possibility, because I try to be open to the fact that, at least in my work, I've missed something, you have state like Minnesota where the county prosecutors are required by law to follow up on any allegations that come to them of a voter fraud. And you have the same situation in Minnesota with respect to no record of fraud there. Hmm. We had a federal program during the Bush administration years that was designed to look at, try to find voter fraud in federal elections. Big effort. The head of the Election Crimes Branch, which in the Justice Department, which is very involved in the program, said at the time that it was essentially the second highest priority at the Justice Department after terrorism to find voter fraud. And in that case, they also had a very paltry record of finding anything. So the idea that it's hard to find doesn't, to me, say anything different about any other crime, and we do find crime. The idea that prosecutors won't pursue it, I think, has to be established with some evidence there, because it doesn't wash with other evidence that we have that it has been attempted to be prosecuted.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Lorraine Manidi. She's Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration, also Director of the Undergraduate Urban Studies Program at Rutgers University at their Camden campus across the river here from us here in Philadelphia, author of a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud and Keeping Down the Black Vote. And we have a full bank of calls here. Let me just ask you, though, one thing, because this comes up in research and in conversations, which has to do with registration fraud. Supporters of these laws often talk about ACORN being charged with registration fraud, registering, Mickey Mouse, people like that. Help us understand the problem, if there is one, of registration fraud, and looking at those ACORN cases, whether those people that were signed up to vote, whether they actually went to the polls to vote.
Right. No. I don't think there's any evidence that any fraudulent registration that was turned in resulted in the casting of a fraudulent ballot. And what you had with the case of ACORN was something that is a problem with the kind of registration system that we have, which is a personal registration system. You have to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Organizations go out and they try to encourage people to vote, and they try to help them register to vote. It's very hard to do. It's labor-intensive. It takes a lot of money. And so in the case of ACORN and other organizations, they have to hire people, sort of like temporary workers. And the people who submitted fraudulent applications were really hurting ACORN as much as anything else, because they wanted to get paid without doing the hard work of knocking on doors or helping people fill out registration applications. That case is completely blown out of the water in terms of how important it was. It is completely exaggerated. There were lots of politics behind the attack on ACORN. That organization, which was in business as a community organization, focused on the needs of poor people. Almost 40-year-old organization does not exist anymore because of this essentially politically motivated attack on them. But the point about registration fraud and how does that happen, it's the same problem with petitions. When candidates have to get signatures to get on the ballot or get signatures to get something on initiative on the ballot, they have to go out and collect signatures. You see the same problem. You see fraudulent signatures coming in that way. It is not a massive problem. It's a problem with the sort of mechanics of the way we do this and the fact that some people are going to rip off their employer. It is a problem for election officials to have to sort through that. They shouldn't have to sort through fraudulent registrations coming in. But so far, the system that we have in place has worked in preventing those registrations from turning into fraudulent votes.
Laurie, let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have, it looks like, Liam from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Liam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just had a question. I wanted to see if you might be able to help clarify this issue for me, because as far as I can tell, it really seems that by and large, this whole voter fraud and voter ID law has really been pushed and championed by self-proclaimed fiscal and social conservatives. But it seems like they don't want to really talk about how they're going to pay for this. So, in the absence of any concrete evidence of voter fraud, it just seems like, how can you be a fiscal conservative and be pushing this, you know, how are you going to pay for the law?
Well, Liam, I know, at least in Pennsylvania, the state gave, I guess, counties or commissioners some money to help with this issue. But let me see what Lori Menidi has to say on this. Is this underfunded? If this is a serious problem, is there enough money to fix the alleged problem?
I think a lot of people are concerned about that, and that it wasn't probably it usually isn't vetted very well, at least in the state legislative debates I've looked at where they've passed these laws. The issue of how much is it going to cost, how are we going to pay for it, how hard is it going to be to implement, those issues have not really gotten the kind of discussion and deliberation they deserve, and they haven't been part of the conversation about kind of costs and benefits of doing that. So I think that is a concern. I think we might be spending money on one part of the election administration apparatus that doesn't need it at the expense of something else. And we do have, I think in general, we have sort of underfunded election administration in the United States.
Liam, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Lori, what about absentee voting? Are there potential problems or real problems with that when it comes to the notion of fraud or mistakes or problems?
Yes, we have had cases of absentee ballot fraud. And again, your Philadelphia area listeners might remember back in the 1990s, there was a case there in a state Senate race involving absentee ballot fraud. And part of the problem is that with absentee ballots, you have a ballot sort of leaving the office, and you have the possibility of third-party groups, if you will, or others who aren't the voter, being part of the process of getting the ballot to the voter, or getting the ballot back to the election office. So there are more points at which the ballot handling can be corrupted. There are some remarkable cases of absentee ballot fraud. I can tell you one other quick one.
Quickly.
In Dodge County, Georgia, in 1996, there was a local election there, and the two candidates running, who were incumbents, one was a 30-year incumbent sheriff, they were actually taking bids on absentee ballot applications inside the city hall.
Wow.
I mean, this is sort of corruption of politicians who have access to the ballots, who were essentially auctioning them off to voters for money. So there are problems with absentee balloting, and again, I think your previous caller made a good point about how are we spending the resources, what's the rational and best way to spend the limited resources we have to try to improve election administration, and I would have, I would point to some areas in the area of absentee balloting as in need of some, review and probably some tightening up.
Well, Lori, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Lorraine Menidi, our guest, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration, also Director of the Undergraduate Urban Studies Program at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. We're talking about, as she describes it, the myth of voter fraud. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Adult classes are forming now for the WHYY Hamilton Commons. Learn about shooting and editing digital video, as well as crafting your own documentary. Classes begin on September 12th with Intro to Shooting Video. On September 19th, enter the world of editing digital video. And in October, a four-week class will help you craft your own documentary. For more information and a full course listing, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
On the next Fresh Air, global weirdness, heat waves, relentless drought, and rising seas. We speak with Michael Lemonick of the group Climate Central, an independent journalism and research organization which has just published a new guide to what we know about the science of climate change and what to expect in the future. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's behind the increase in Afghanistan of green-on-blue violence? People in green Afghan army uniforms killing NATO troops. Also, the wildly popular 50 Shades of Grey finally spawns a parody, the far more risque 50 Shades of Earl Grey. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Got a bit ahead of myself there, talking with Lorraine Maniti about voter ID laws and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have Adrian from Lower Merion. Adrian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air, Adrian.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I am the majority inspector in Lower Merion A2. That is an elected position where I am one of the people that sits behind the table and takes the book, and
sure.
So you put your signature in.
Yep.
Those signatures have to match. If those signatures do not match, then the person has to present ID to prove who they are. And it can sometimes get tricky because some people have been voting for 50 years, and it's a signature from 50 years ago. And this law does not address any cases of voter fraud. Here's the issue. One, it does not address anything with absentee ballots. The ID, if you have a driver's license or you have a photo ID, for example, it does not have to have a current address. So if you re-registered, you have carte blanche to vote in two districts.
Well, Agent, hold on one second. Let me take your comments and give Lorraine Maniti a chance to weigh in on that. And you're someone who works the polls. She's the person behind the desk where you sign in with your signature, Lori.
Yes, I think that is very, hard work on election day. We appreciate people who do that and who run for office to do that work. And the signature match form of identification is what most states had really before about 5, 6, 7 years ago when these photo ID laws began to be passed. And it was an innovation in the early 1900s and into the 1920s, it was recommended as a great reform to ensure the integrity of the elections, and it sort of was the method that we used for a very long time and seemed to meet both the needs to make sure that the person presenting themselves, was who he or she said they were, and also to keep the burden on the voter down. To not require that you bring your papers with you when you vote, because that may not everybody's going to have all those documents that they may need. So it was a balance between protecting the integrity of elections and keeping the franchise access to the ballot as open as possible.
Would you say that a signature is still as effective today as it was 100 years ago?
I think that's probably true. We have a system of registration. Registration also was an innovation, was a method that was adopted to, again, ensure integrity of elections. You have to register some number of days, and it varies in different states, before an election. And now, with the Help America Vote Act, which is a federal law passed in 2002, you have to provide more information on the registration application that election officials are supposed to verify. Hmm. Your driver's license number or the last four digits of your Social Security number must be provided on that, and you have to show states like Pennsylvania adopted additional rules for showing ID the first time you vote in a new jurisdiction. You have to show documents when you vote. So we have both. We have registration at which an identity check is made, and we have some rules in place, again, when people move around so much to ensure they are who they are when they vote. And I think signature match has served us pretty well.
Adrian, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Carol from Delaware County has to say. And Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was a former judge of election, and I can tell you, I believe that we're really way off base. We have to make technology that is available to us now current in the minds of people. It's the process is we get a Social Security number when we're born, we get a voter ID notice from the Social Security Administration when we're 18 to remind us to vote. If we vote, that number goes on our record, because you know you're followed around from the moment you get a Social Security number, and when you're 65 you get the benefits of being an American. Everything in between can be fraught with fraud and racism and all these other things, but the voter ID number and the voter ID card has nothing to do with racial or emotional.
Carol, let me just stop you. You said when you turn 65, you have the privilege of being an American. What do you mean by that?
No, you have the privileges of benefits in the Social Security system.
Okay, but you're saying that a Social Security card is a card that we get at birth. It follows us around through life, and that should be how we identify ourselves when we go to vote?
No, it's the Social Security system that should remind us at 18 to register to vote, because that's the next leg of the journey of being an American.
Right.
You know, when you're registered to vote, then you go to school, you get ID, you go to college, you get ID, you become an engineer, you get certification. All the numbers that happen in between are from the day that you're allegedly supposed to register to vote, at least at the age to register to vote. I have a lot of things to say about the fraud. I have a lot of things to say about everything, but, you know, this is a radio show and not a discussion. I would like to open this up to a bigger discussion, because both of the experts are dancing around, you know, what the reality is.
Well, Carol, let me just stop you there, and we like to have discussions even on the radio, but are you saying that there is voter fraud and the law, at least in Pennsylvania, you're from Delaware County, that the law is necessary?
No, I think it's much, much deeper than that. It's systemic. You know, you don't send in a blank registration form to the Bureau of Elections and call that registering to vote.
Right.
It should be serialized. When your application is put in the database, that should be available information immediately, because we have now streaming video.
It sounds like, and let me put that to you, Lorraine. I think what Carol is saying is that we have a technology that should allow us to make voting perhaps available and protected.
Yes, I think Carol is making very good common sense kinds of recommendations, but it has proven to be much more difficult to achieve these things for a whole host of reasons, including political ones. And remember, I just as a kind of sidebar to this, politicians make these rules. They make these rules, and it is the history of election law in the United States that people fight over trying to create advantage for one side or the other, one group or the other. These laws are highly political, and the politics is really a problem. And I'll just give you an example. I mean, Carol is kind of pointing to the fact that we interact with government really all the time. Why aren't we better either tracked, or why aren't we registered to vote when we turn 18 automatically? A lot of reformers are trying to figure out how to do that kind of automatic voter registration that would follow you around wherever you went. The example is the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. It's a long time ago that law was passed. That law requires social service agencies in the United States who deal with federal money, food stamps, welfare benefits, driver's licenses, the DMV. You're familiar with being asked, are you registered to vote when you go to the DMV? That was an attempt to try to capture that information when people interact with government and get people registered that way. And it has been successful, pretty successful on the DMV side with those agencies. It's been thwarted and not implemented, Marty. It's really remarkable. It's a federal law not implemented in many places in the United States in social service agencies. So when Carol was kind of pointing out, you know, we apply for benefits, the Social Security system, and so forth, there was an attempt to do this. It was actually a 10-year effort to try to get that law passed in 1993, and we're looking at almost 20 years since the law was passed, and it just has been prevented from being implemented. So there are lots of obstacles to doing what seems like should be common sense, and we have the know-how, we have the technological ability. We often don't have the money, and we don't have the political will. That's really, I think, what it comes down to.
Carol, I appreciate the call to Radio Times to see what Paul from Levittown has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Already addressed the issue that I'm seeing. I think, and maybe you talked about it earlier, comment by Pennsylvania legislator Terzai, that the voter requirement will allow the Republican Party to win, and the reported NPR studies that all these in all states laws are put through by Republican legislators. And as she mentioned, these things are for political advantage. I just wonder, you know, all of that being pretty much, I mean, you know, please comment if you want about that, but I wonder if there's any kind of possible backlash that people, voters, would perceive these laws to be discriminatory and anti-democratic and would possibly vote against people who are pushing these laws. Thank you very much.
Paul, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I don't know whether you can look into your crystal ball there, Lori. Do you see a backlash on this issue?
Well, I think you're seeing a little bit of that when people become aware of it and when they become aware of the disproportionate burden that the laws create. And it's not just a kind of a racial impact. It's an impact on, again, on poor people, especially, who could have the most problem getting the proper ID, paying for the underlying documents. A number of the plaintiffs in the Pennsylvania case have really compelling stories about how difficult it is for them to get birth records, for example, from states they were born in the South that don't have any record of their birth and so forth. So the law is, these ID laws made seem like really what's the big deal for, for most people. Most people in this country, adults, have a driver's license. Most people might not have so much difficulty obtaining a birth certificate and so forth. That's not the point. The point is that when it has a disproportionate burden on certain groups of people, and even at a small percentage of people who might be affected, 2, 3, 4, 5% sounds small. It's thousands and thousands and maybe millions of people in the United States who are citizens, who deserve the right, you know, who have earned, not earned, they have the right to vote in this country, being made difficult for them for what we think are kind of political reasons. I don't know, you know, I don't have any insight into either party's long-term thinking about these laws. What I know from my work is that election laws have always been used by politicians to try to create an advantage of some kind. I don't quite know what the math is for either party, but it just makes sense. I mean, politicians are rational actors too. That they perceive some advantage here in these laws affecting certain groups of people and redounding to their electoral, therefore their electoral benefit.
And it looks like all the research has found that those people who are disadvantaged by these voter ID laws tend to be older people, younger people, and people of who are low income.
Low income, people who are less educated sometimes, because you have to be able to navigate the system to find the, fill out the forms, find the forms, figure out where to go, have the means to get there. And those sorts of resources, which middle-class people, in a sense, they have taken for granted that they can operate in a world like this, for others, it's more difficult. And so, you know, should we be passing laws that make it more difficult for so many, you know, of our fellow citizens who don't have the resources we have to be able to vote? I want to make one quick point.
Okay, go ahead.
You know,
go ahead.
In this debate, it often gets polarized, not only in terms of partisan terms, but in terms of this idea that there is a kind of tension between access to the ballot and the integrity of the electoral process. And I would like to suggest that you can't have integrity in an election if you don't have full participation. So we have to think about the fact that we're not all positioned in the same way with respect to resources, and make sure that our laws don't discriminate, you know, against people who don't have as much as maybe some of the rest of us do, in both money and education and access and networks and so forth. We don't have integrity in elections if we don't have full access.
And I hate to raise this with 1 minute to go, but we've been talking about voter fraud. Is there a problem of election fraud, whether it has to do with parties or candidates or groups?
We do have that kind of election fraud. But again, you know, the way my approach is, what's the rationale? Who has the most to gain? Politicians have a lot to gain in the outcome of elections. And so where we have a problem with election fraud, it's usually committed by politicians, by campaign workers, candidates, sometimes election officials in collusion, trying to engage in vote rigging, ballot box stuffing. There's even a case, a sentencing last year of 9 people in Kentucky, all of them government officials, who were engaged in switching votes on electronic voting machines. So politicians have maybe more at stake, you know, than the average voter, and that motivation may drive them to try to get around the rules and get around the laws and corrupt the process. I would not say that it is a massive problem, but we certainly have cases of that.
Well, Lori Menidi, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. She's Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration, also Director of the Undergraduate Urban Studies Program at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. I wrote a book called The Myth of Voter Fraud and another one called Keeping Down the Black Vote. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of the show. We have assistance today from Jonathan Best, the program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.